If you've listened to the show for any length of time, you know that I'm a big fan of connecting with locals when you're traveling someplace. If you're just going to be inside the tour bus, then you might as well stay home. The best parts of travel for me are when you get out into the marketplace or into the cafe where you meet the locals and have a chance to interact. If you're also looking to experience this, then check out Explore Worldwide, whose local tour leaders will get you off the beaten track and into the heart of the adventure, helping you get past being a tourist, experiencing local culture, and finding places you would not find by yourself. And isn't that what travel is all about? If you're thinking about your next adventure, head to exploreworldwide.com to find out more.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 728. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about camels and temples, tombs and Islamic art, feluccas and pyramids, as we go to Egypt. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about one of my favorite countries, Egypt. I'd like to welcome the show Sally El-Basir from PassportAndPlates.com, who has come to talk to us about Egypt. Sally, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'd like to say that Egypt is one of the few places that makes my short list of when people say, where in the world was your favorite place to travel? Egypt is often in that top three or so that I mentioned, but I haven't been there since 2010, so I didn't want to do an episode. So glad that I found somebody who knows more about it than I do. But Sally, what is your connection to Egypt?
Yeah, so I'm actually part Egyptian. And
that's where Sally comes from, I assume.
Yeah. So it's funny actually, because I was born in Ireland and my parents wanted a name that anyone could pronounce regardless of what they spoke. So that's how I ended up with the name Sally. But my mom's Egyptian. And so I try to go back and visit family once a year or so. So that's kind of how I ended up just learning a lot about what the cool things to do are in Egypt.
Excellent. And why should someone go to Egypt?
I think anybody who has ever studied history in the world is fascinated by the ancient Egyptians, right? I mean, I think it's a bucket list place for many people, and you don't need a lot of convincing to go there. But I have to add that Egypt is really a country that has something for everyone. And I think a lot of people don't know that. So yes, it's very rich in history, but at the same time, it also has beautiful beach resorts. If you're a diver, there's tons of diving spots that are really famous, really great food, just amazing culture, music, art. No matter what you're interested in, there's something cool and fun to see there.
Excellent. Yeah, as a history buff, the history is what attracts me, but it is good that you point out there's so much else that is available in Egypt. And what kind of itinerary are you going to recommend for us?
Yeah, so I mean, I think for a 1 week itinerary to Egypt, there's sort of, I would say, a more typical route, which includes a few days in Cairo, and then maybe one day in Alexandria, and then making your way all the way down south, doing a Nile cruise to Upper Egypt, so Luxor and Aswan.
Excellent. And that's, we might as well address it now, down to Upper Egypt is always something that's a little confusing for people. It's up the river, but yes, down the map.
Right. Yeah. So it's south, but like towards Sudan, but it's called Upper Egypt.
Excellent. So you started us in Cairo.
Yeah. Most flights come into Cairo. Mm-hmm. So it sort of just makes the most sense to start there. Plus, that's where the pyramids of Giza are. And usually anyone that comes to Egypt in general, that's what they're most excited about, right?
So they're probably worth seeing, is what you're saying.
I mean, you know, I think you can't go to Egypt without seeing them, right? It's just, right. It doesn't happen. One thing that I would recommend too is not just spending the day at the pyramids of Giza, as tempting as that is. Mm-hmm. So first day, it's like, you should definitely spend a few hours there, see the Sphinx. Everyone knows that that's the thing to do in Cairo. But what most people don't know is there are other pyramids in Egypt that are just arguably just as cool and far emptier and less touristy compared to the pyramids of Giza, including the Saqqara pyramid, which is a step pyramid or multiple step pyramids, and includes a bunch of tombs and temples as well. And then there's also a smaller one called Dahshur. So I would say, like, make a day of it and spend the entire day exploring different pyramids.
Well, and let me ask for a clarification here. So in terms of history, ancient Egyptian history, not modern history, is broken up into the Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, and the New Kingdom, which is a long, long time ago.
Right.
But we're still talking about the Old Kingdom?
I believe so. So okay. Don't quote me on that, because
I know that the original pyramids of Giza are the Old Kingdom. And just to put in context how old is in this context, people have heard of Cleopatra, who is like from the time of Julius Caesar. She was a contemporary. In fact, she bore him a child, so you had to be a contemporary for that. And she is closer to us in time than she is to when the pyramids were built, by something like 500 years. And I remember when we stood at the pyramids, one of the reasons that Egypt makes my top three list is our guide was an Egyptologist, which is very typical. And he was telling us about the Old Kingdom fell to the Sea Peoples. We don't really know who they are. We don't know where they came from. We don't know much about them. They've kind of disappeared from history after this, but we think that they toppled the Old Kingdom, and they had an unfair advantage because they had the wheel. And you're standing there looking at the Pyramid of Giza going, I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah, it's so grand and impressive, right? And it makes you, I've been to the Pyramids of Giza multiple times, and it's still, it just astounds me how they managed to build such a grand structure that's withstood all of this time, thousands of years, with, you know, really no technology.
Not a lot. Yeah, apparently they had logs and things like that, but they lubricated the ramps with milk, is what we were told. It's like,
okay,
seriously, okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because there's so many different theories that are always like floating around about how the pyramids were built. So,
and we're not even getting into spaceships at that point. So, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So, in terms of, let's talk about Giza here for a second. Would you recommend that people take the time to go in the pyramids if that option is open when they're there?
Having done that myself, I would say that's, you should skip it. So going inside the pyramid is basically going through like a small kind of claustrophobic tunnel.
Sure.
And there's really nothing inside the pyramids. Everything that was found when they excavated is in the Egyptian Museum.
Right.
And so I personally feel like that was the one part of the pyramids experience that is worth skipping.
Okay, well, that's why I asked, because you didn't bring it up, and I didn't do it, so I regret it. But those who have done it I've heard a lot of them have the same feedback that you had, which is
yeah.
How about doing a camel ride? Because I'm going to be offered.
Yes, so I know I'm a little bit on the fence about the camel rides. I think it's, if you choose to do it, you have to make sure that you're looking at a camel that looks healthy and doesn't look like they're, I think in terms of animal care in Egypt, it's definitely not at quite the same level as maybe in the US. And so a lot of times you'll find that camels and other animals that are used to transport people at touristy areas in general are not quite as taken care of as I would like. So the very first time I went to Egypt when I was a kid, I did do that. But the visits that I did after, I skipped out on that.
Well, and I've done it in Upper Egypt at a Nubian village, and that seemed very, very different. It seemed like
yes,
much more authentic and less touristy and less sketchy,
Yes, no, absolutely. I think there's farming communities down in Upper Egypt. And so because of that, people actually take care of the animals. They're really well fed. And you can tell. Yep. I mean, if you see an animal that looks kind of like bony and underfed versus when you go to Upper Egypt, they take care of their animals there. And so there, I wouldn't be opposed to recommending a camel or donkey ride or anything like that.
Excellent. So you were taking us to some other sites and you took us to another set of pyramids. Where else should we go?
So I think that's probably like a solid first day in Egypt. That's a really action-packed day that you have. Okay. You could do dinner, maybe like a sunset Nile cruise. Okay. They're usually about an hour just around the city, and they're really nice and relaxing. And then the following couple of days, sort of depending on where your interests lie, mm-hmm. there's a bunch of cool stuff to do. One thing that I would recommend is actually visiting Coptic Cairo.
Oh,
and
okay.
Yeah, so a lot of people don't know that, or maybe they kind of skip over Coptic Cairo, but Egypt is about 10% Coptic Orthodox, mm-hmm. and there's like this area, it's still filled with a lot of historical churches and kind of like where there's like a big congregation of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think that's something that's, it's worth highlighting that Egypt is not just a Muslim country, right? There's definitely...
Sure.
a lot worth seeing in Coptic Cairo. And the convenient part is it's kind of nearby the citadel. And so once you kind of do probably like a half day or so, you can also head over to the citadel. And from there, there's really beautiful views of Cairo. There's a historical mosque there mm-hmm. that you can visit. And it's also a museum.
You're talking about the Muhammad Ali Mosque.
Yes. So that's like within the citadel of Cairo.
Built in the style of Hagia Sophia in Turkey because of its connection to
yes.
the Turkish rulers of Cairo. Well, the people who rebelled from the Turkish rulers, of, I should say.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, back in the Ottoman Empire days and all that
I think
good
we're,
stuff.
I think we're pre-Ottoman Empire at this point. I think we're going back to the Mamluks, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yes, you're right. You're right. See, you're much better at remembering history
I'll do
than
the history.
I am.
Okay. The citadel you're talking about is up on a hill above Cairo, which is why there's such great views.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so to me, you know, that's definitely a place that's worth visiting. And you just get the most spectacular views. And even and visiting that mosque is just...
It's very beautiful.
Yeah, it's so beautifully made. The architecture is just so impressive, you know, mm-hmm. to me. And it's like a huge historical monument in Egypt. So it's to me, that's like a place I would add to that.
And not named after like, the boxer, despite the similarity of names.
Right, exactly.
Well, and you said Coptic Cairo and a number of churches, the best known one I know there is the Hanging Church. I don't know if that's where you're recommending we go.
That is part of Coptic Cairo in the sense of like conceptually, although it's not where there's like that big congregation of churches.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hanging Church is definitely worth seeing. And I think somewhere a lot of people skip just because it's a little bit harder to get to.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it's located like within sort of a cave. I don't know if you got a chance to visit when you were there.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is like probably the most unique church that I've seen in all of my travels. I mean, what do you think?
I've seen a lot of churches, so I don't know if I'd go, I don't think you'd get me to go that far, but it was interesting.
Right. I do feel like in Egypt that there's a lot of, especially in Cairo, they make use of the space that's there, right? It's a really crowded city, but mm-hmm. even so, it's like, I don't know, where else do you find like cave churches and just sort of every single aspect of the city, it's like you can tell they're really making use of the space, for better or worse.
Excellent. What else should we see while we're in Cairo?
Now that we've done kind of Coptic Cairo, mm-hmm. Islamic Cairo, it's a popular spot for sure for tourists. There is a bazaar called Khan al-Khalili. That bazaar and the surrounding areas are just filled with historical monuments and so many old buildings. And that area, a lot of people still live and work there. And so mm-hmm. you're really getting an authentic Cairo experience. I mean, the bazaar, I have to say, is definitely a little bit on the touristy side, but
sure.
it's really kind of...
With full contact vendors?
Yes, yeah. There's no social distancing there.
No. My wife didn't love that they would put the scarf on her and then try and sell it to her. And
right. Yeah, it's your... I mean, it's definitely like you have to kind of brace yourself. It's a, mm-hmm. like I said, all the senses, full sensory experience going into that bazaar. But I have to say that once you go a little bit outside of just that specific area, that a lot of the surrounding buildings have a lot of history behind mm-hmm. them as well. There's also like a cool cafe called mm-hmm. El Fishawi, and it's just a fun place where you kind of sit and sort of watch the chaos happen around you. There's usually live music, you know, you could have mm-hmm. like tea with mint and just kind of enjoy it, but like in a far removed way, which I think is something that like people kind of prefer that vibe.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying people shouldn't go there. I love a good bazaar and I love a souk. I'm just trying to prepare you
yes,
for what
absolutely.
To expect.
I mean, vendors are not going to leave you alone. They definitely, they love tourists. They want mm-hmm. you to buy their stuff. I think like most bazaars, but it's still, even though I know it can be a little bit overwhelming, I still recommend that area mm-hmm. because I think you shouldn't go just for the bazaar. The bazaar should be a stop. But especially if you're there with a guide should be able to show you around not just that area, but also a lot of the other buildings. There's also another mosque that's there that's also really historically significant. And any good guide will should know about there's actually like a Sufi temple that does authentic like whirling. I kind of hate that word, but like whirling dervishes. And it's not a show that's created for tourists. It's actually just, they do it all the time. It's their actual full song and dance mm-hmm. and ritual. And they offer it for people to come and watch and enjoy the experience.
And what is the name of that?
So the place is called Wekelet El Ghouri. And I can send you that.
It's the Arts Center. Got it.
Yes. Sorry, there's a lot of places that I actually only know the Arabic name for. So
that's not a problem. We'll put them in the show notes.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, that is, to me, that was like one of the most amazing things in that area for sure.
Excellent. The only place I can think of you haven't taken us yet is the Cairo Museum.
Yes. And so there's a reason for that, actually.
I figured there was.
So it's sort of in transition right now. Mm-hmm. So the Egyptian Museum is spectacular. It's actually located in Tahrir Square, so mm-hmm. just like the heart of downtown Cairo. But over the last couple of years, they've actually been trying to move it so that it's next to the pyramids of Giza.
Right.
Just because a lot of the artifacts that were found in the actual pyramids were in the museum, and so they decided that it makes more sense to have the museum and the pyramids next to each other. I believe the last I heard is that it's supposed to open in 2021, but there's been a lot of delays in transfer and opening of the museum, which is why I don't recommend visiting it right now until it's officially open, in which case it'll be amazing and definitely worth going.
Well, and when you say it was amazing, I visited it 10 years ago in Tahrir Square before everything else happened in Tahrir Square, but it was an incredible collection, I would agree, but it was displayed a little bit like Grandma's attic. it needed some work in terms of presentation.
Right.
You know, in terms of collection, there's nothing that can rival it. But that's one of the things I'm looking forward to with the new museum is they're not just moving it, they're updating it. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, because that new one isn't open yet, so I'm not able to speak to what it'll look like. But based on the photos that I've seen of what it will look like, it does look like it'll definitely be getting an upgrade. The one that was located in Tahrir Square was very much outdated, you know, kind of dim lighting.
It would have looked the same in 1950 that it did when I visited it in 2010.
Unfortunately, kind of haphazardly organized. But I'm hoping that the new one will be a truly spectacular experience, as well as the collection, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think another thing that people miss is also that depending on how much time you have in Cairo, right, there's actually a lot of really cool sort of smaller museums that are worth seeing as well. So depending on how much time you have, like, for example, the Museum of Islamic Arts is on the newer side. And to me, that was like a very impressive display of art from not just from Egypt, but from all over the world in various forms. So paintings, furniture, different mosaics. Another place that I would actually also recommend for people to visit if they have time is to watch the sunset from the Al-Azhar Park.
Okay.
So it's not, again, a lot of tourists don't really go there, and it's mostly like a local hangout. But to me, going there at sunset, one of the coolest things is you're not just getting amazing views and the colors. You're standing at a point where multiple mosques do the call to prayer at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so you can actually hear them echoing from sort of all around you, coming all around probably like 10 or so different directions. And it's just awe-inspiring. And to me, I think that's something a lot of tourists miss out on.
Now, you mentioned something about a guide. Before we were recording, I was talking to Sally and I said that I was there with the very first amateur traveler trip and we were there on a bus tour with 40 people. Wonderful guide, but don't do that.
Yeah, definitely.
But on the other hand, there's so many places in Egypt that it was helpful to have a guide. It's just that I would do it in a smaller group. If it was my first trip. Who would you recommend should do it independently versus sort of small group travel?
I think I would say people that maybe haven't traveled so much in maybe like the Middle East or okay. North Africa, I would recommend having a guide or going on like a small group trip. So for me, actually, I'd gone to Egypt a lot when I was younger and then mm-hmm. I hadn't been for about 9 years. There was like a big gap there. So when I went back for the first time in 2017, I actually took an Intrepid Travel trip.
Okay, sure.
Intrepid Travel specializes in small group trips. And so I was there with, I believe it was 6 other people. So it was like a really nice intimate group that we had. And our guide is an Egyptian local. And it was great. I think they're able to offer sort of an additional layer of cultural understanding. Yep. And obviously mm-hmm. history that just you really can't do on your own. And I would say in Egypt specifically, even in Cairo, English is not quite as widespread as sure. it is in some other touristy countries. Mm-hmm. And so I think having a guide is just a great way to kind of, you know, give you that sort of ease of mind.
Excellent. Anything else we want to talk about in Cairo before we head upriver down the map?
Yeah, no, I think that's kind of everything. I mean, the thing is like I have a blog post called 30 Things to Do in Cairo. So there's okay. a ton. I just have to add that there's a ton of things to do in Cairo that like I understand that most people only go for a few days. So I kind of gave you a basic overview, but you're never going to run out of things to do in Cairo. So if that's like a place that you're spending a lot of time, then by all means.
What of the things on your 30 list that you uh-huh. didn't mention, what was the one that was the most painful not to recommend to people?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Thank you. And I will put a link to all 30, put a link to the show notes to the blog post from Sally.
So one thing that I recommend if someone had additional time to do is actually the Palace of Muhammad Ali, also known as Manial Palace.
Okay.
Built in the 1900s by Prince Muhammad Ali. And it's seriously underrated. It has an extensive collection of well-preserved artifacts from that time and just kind of showcases what life was like a century ago. Really beautiful, slightly gaudy architecture and furniture. And to me, I just feel like I really felt transported back in time. And, you know, the best part was that it was virtually empty when I went, which is always nice to be able to go to a tourist site and not feel like there's a ton of people around.
Well, and we have to say then, because you put a date on when he had a palace, I was wrong about the Muhammad Ali Mosque because it's from the same time period. It's the citadel that was built by the Mamluks. I got that transfused there. I got that confused there.
Gotcha.
So both the mosque and the palace are from the Ottoman period.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. See, I mean, I think Egypt has such a long and rich history. It's yes. very easy to get confused. No worries.
Excellent. Well, shall we head south then?
Yes, so we head south. One thing that I absolutely loved on the tour that I did is doing a Nile cruise. So there's sort of two different approaches that you can take in terms of going south. You can take a Nile, like a 3-day Nile cruise if mm-hmm. you have the time.
All the way from Cairo.
Yes, all the way from Cairo down to Aswan. But what we actually ended up doing is we took the train. So they have overnight trains that leave from Cairo to Aswan and to Luxor. And they're really comfortable. They're great. They have sleeper beds. It's really, really a fun experience. And then we ended up doing like a day-long felucca ride.
Okay.
So a felucca is a traditional Egyptian sailboat. Mm-hmm. And so one of the days on my tour that I did was we just kind of spent the day sort of sailing down the Nile, like it was great. Some of us jumped off and swam for a bit. We just kind of sat on the boat and just sort of enjoyed the ambiance and the warm weather. You know, I went in February. Upper Egypt is warm all year round, which is great. So that would be something that I would recommend, or doing a Nile cruise. That being said, I understand that some people are short on time, and so you have the option of either taking that overnight train south, or you can also fly from Cairo to Aswan or Luxor.
Yeah, we did the fly to Aswan, see the dams, see some of the well-known sites there, and then cruised down to Luxor, which is very typical, and often starts like ours some ridiculously early hour in the morning.
Yes. I think it's depending on the kind of cruise you do. Like if you end up sailing, right, they definitely want ample time for you to go south at a leisurely pace. If you're taking a cruise that's motorized, obviously there's a little bit more control over how quickly you can go.
Excellent. So you're taking us from north to south. So the first stop we would make would be Luxor.
Correct.
Excellent. And what are we going to see in Luxor?
Yeah, so Luxor, there's a ton to see in Luxor. It is really like anyone who's interested in Egyptian history, I mean, especially ancient Egyptian history, like this is their dream spot, even more than Cairo, I would say. So you have the Valley of the Kings, which is where you could see the pharaoh's tombs and burial chambers. It's extensive, really spectacular, just a huge collection of different tombs.
And we say a huge collection of different tombs. So I'm going to go and I'm going to see all of them in one day, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, yes. So well, basically wait, how it works is like you, so there's an admission fee.
Right. I was going to say, well, no.
Technically, yeah, you can. So there's an admission fee to the actual, to the complex, right? The Valley of the Kings, which usually includes a few of the tombs. And then you pay extra depending on which ones you're more interested in seeing.
And I want to say the admission fee included like three tombs or something like that.
Yes.
Something in that range.
Yeah. And then they have different ones according to like whatever people are interested in seeing. So if there's like a particular temple or tomb that you're interested in seeing in the Valley of the Kings, you can pay and do that, which is kind of cool. I like that people have the option.
Okay. And in terms of tombs, they are not all alike. Do you have ones that you would recommend if people... So you're not also necessarily going to be able to see the one you want. Some are open someday and some are not. But if I had my choice, where would you take me?
One temple to me that's one of the most spectacular ones is the Temple of Ramses the 5th and 6th. So it's actually one of the largest tombs and it has sort of a long hallway, tons of like stairs, and every single aspect of it is decorated from the ceiling to the sides. Even it's truly a work of art and very well restored. I mean, I think they've done a really good job of taking care of it and restoring the colors
Actually, a lot of those aren't even restored. They're just original colors, which is the stunning thing when you think about how old some of these are.
That's
really? My understanding from our guide.
Okay.
Because they were so well preserved being out here in the desert, for one thing. But a lot of the times, I think you're seeing the original pigment, and some of them are bright.
Yes. I mean, hence why I thought they were restored, actually.
Well, I could be wrong. I have been wrong already on this podcast. So,
you know, let's just say that it'll be a mystery for whoever shows up. They'll learn something new when they go to Egypt, right? I believe that there's a few of them that they're restoring. I don't know if that it's specifically that one that I mentioned, but I do think that there was a couple, like I saw an article a few years ago that they were restoring at least one of the temples in the Valley of the Kings. Yeah, so that's definitely, I would say, if you are going to choose one temple to visit, that's the one to go to, because that was my favorite one personally.
Well, and I didn't get a chance to go to the Tutankhamun tomb when I was there, which is probably the best known one and probably the least interesting one in terms of there's just not a lot there. He died rather quickly. They buried him rather quickly. There is so much in the Egyptian museum from there because it wasn't found by tomb robbers, which is why it's so significant. But in terms of being spectacular, not so much.
Right. So if I remember correctly, that one had the mummified body of the king, and that was like
it. No, it had a whole room full of stuff. That's all ended up in the Egyptian Museum, but it was like one room sort of thing.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I mean in the Valley
yes,
of the Kings.
Yes, I think that is correct.
Clarify. Yeah. From what I remember, it was like that one just had the mummy. So that when you go to the Valley of the Kings, that's all you can see. But you're right. Yeah, like most of the artifacts are on display in the Egyptian Museum there. So I think it's definitely one that you could easily skip.
Okay. Well, and when we talk about the Valley of the Kings, I want to say that most of the Ramses, who are predominantly the names you will see there, are in the New Kingdom. So it's not as old. It's 1000 BC, 1100 BC, something like that.
Right. Yeah, so I believe, if I'm not mistaken, there's only a couple, or I want to say 2 to 4 Ramses that are available to see in the Valley of the Kings. So yeah, like you said, there's definitely others that are not included in this time period.
Excellent. What else are we going to do when we are in Luxor?
The next place that I would recommend is also seeing the Karnak Temple, and it is actually one of the largest temples in the area, if not in Egypt, and it has a mix of decayed temples, of columns, like it's really like a cool, like you could easily spend just a couple of hours exploring that complex.
Well, and one of the interesting things for me with the Karnak Temple is that it had been used by so many people over the years. You can see where there's the ancient temple, and then 20 feet up is the door to a mosque, which is hanging nowhere now because they dug out the temple after the mosque was built there. And then deep in the temple, you can find places where there are ancient early Christian paintings because a portion of it was used for the early Christians for worship. So it's this interesting mixture of things, and it's just stunning, just a fascinating place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it's, like you said, there's like a huge mixture of different time periods. And I think you can see that because there are, like, even if you're not an Egyptologist or somebody who's super aware of the ancient Egyptian history, just to the visible eye, like you can see all these differences between various aspects of mm-hmm. the temple.
Well, and it's this whole forest of very Egyptian columns, which means close together and very wide. Just an interesting atmospheric place.
Definitely, I think the columns are the most, or it's kind of like what makes it iconically like, this is Karnak Temple, the temple with all the right. columns in it. Those like really huge circumference and lots of intricate carvings on mm-hmm. them as well. Yeah, so definitely would recommend that one. And then I think the other temple, there's a ton of other things to see in general in Luxor, but I think this is the last temple I would recommend, just because I think after a while people get a little bit templed out. I mean, depending on like your level of interest in like ancient Egyptian history again. But I would say Luxor Temple is probably like the last one that I would say is a must visit. And that one was constructed, I believe it was like 1400 BC, if I'm not mistaken. It was the only one that was not dedicated to like a pharaoh in okay. death. People have hypothesized that it was where a lot of pharaohs were crowned
okay.
during periods of time. It's just a completely, it has just sort of a totally different ambiance, I feel like, compared to the other temples in the area. And then that one also has a large obelisk mm-hmm. in the front. And if I'm not mistaken, its twin obelisk is actually located in Paris.
Okay. That was the one given by Cleopatra the 7th to... No, it's not given by her. Sorry. It was given by Egypt or stolen by Napoleon. I can't remember which, but yeah.
Right. I want to say it was gifted, but it also probably could have been stolen, and gifted might have been a euphemism.
Right, right. Well, and you talk about there being so many temples, and I think I may have confused everything I said, I think, about the Karnak Temple was the Luxor Temple. So there really are a lot of temples, and you're seeing them all in a short period of time. The only thing I'd say is you didn't give any reference to any of the queens. And there's a couple interesting, you know, obviously there's the Valley of the Queens, but there's also
the Hatshepsut temple.
Exactly, of the woman who ruled yeah. as pharaoh, wearing a fake beard and True. Everything like that, who is later on, you can see how her image was carved out of her temple by her son.
Right.
It's an interesting story.
It is. To be honest, I mean, I think Hatshepsut, she's like... I mean, if we're going to talk about a like iconic feminist of ancient Egypt, it's Hatshepsut. Much respect to Cleopatra, but Hatshepsut is really like, she was
Cleopatra was Greek for one thing. Oh, right. So she would be a descendant of one of the generals of Alexander the Great. And so very, very different. She ruled as an Egyptian, but not really.
Right. Okay, so I enjoyed my visit to Hatshepsut Temple. I think if we're going to look at it as an objective temple from like sort of a grand, impressive, lots of cool things to see and do within the temple, it's a little bit less impressive compared to the other ones that I've recommended. That being said, I think Hatshepsut is like honestly amazing. She's the only female pharaoh. And for that, it is worth seeing just, or at least at the very least, like learning her story. Like if you're fortunate enough to have an Egyptologist that's for a guide, they should definitely talk to you about Hatshepsut, because to me, she's like one of the most impressive figures in ancient Egyptian history. So if you have time, yes, it's definitely worth visiting her temple as well. But I did feel like kind of just when I did travel there in a group, I think people were a little bit like, we're done with temples after
I get that.
42, you know what I mean? In like 2 days, I think everybody was a little bit just like, we're kind of done with the temples now.
Where else would you send people, either in Luxor, or is it time to move on?
In Luxor, I would say it's kind of time to move on. I mean, you have the Valley of the Queens, if that's something you're also interested in. I'd say it's not as impressive as the Valley of the Kings. There's also the statues of Colossi and Memnon, but you can just kind of drive by and like, take a look at them. They're just these huge ancient Egyptian like sandstone statues. Usually they just like pause for like a photo op there.
Well, and not well preserved either.
They're just big. <That's true. laughs> they're huge and in your face and impressive in that sense, but yeah, not really well preserved. And I believe like the faces were kind of slowly deteriorating when I went last time.
Sounds about right.
I would say at that point you would move on. So 2 to 3 days is like a solid amount of time in Luxor. Okay. Again, if you have more time, you can totally take it at a leisurely pace, but I know that most people end up kind of in Egypt for about a week or so. Assuming that. So you would head to Aswan after that. You said you did a Nile cruise from Luxor to Aswan, correct?
The other way around. We started in Aswan and then ended in Luxor, which is nice from a sort of a point of view that some of your most spectacular sites, like the Valley of the Kings, are the end. But,
right. Okay. And the itinerary kind of just sort of depends on whoever's planning it, but they're not, you know, they're not far from each other. It's like an hour. So you can take the train between the two. I believe the train's actually like 45 minutes. Mm. You can take a boat cruise between the two. There's no flying, or you can take like an overland, like a car. So Aswan's on the smaller side. I wouldn't say that there's a ton to do there per se, but it doesn't mean that it's worth skipping, because to me, one of the coolest things about Egypt and specifically Aswan is the Nubian villages. Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to visit when you went?
I did.
Yeah. So to me, that was something that I actually, the first time I went to Aswan, I didn't see them, and then I was really upset that I somehow missed that. So I would say the three highlights of Aswan are the dam, the unfinished obelisk, and the Nubian villages. So to me, the Nubian villages are the star of the show. It's interesting because Nubian culture is actually, it's almost like its own like mini culture within Egypt and even within Upper Egypt, right?
Sure.
So the Nubians have their own language that they still speak to each other today. And there's a lot of trust in that community. So a lot of the Nubian store owners, for example, they don't lock their shops overnight because there's just this inherent trust that nobody's going to like take your stuff. It's crazy to me as a concept, but also really, really amazing that they have just such a strong, tight-knit community. And then the Nubian villages themselves are these absolutely like beautifully painted houses. I want to say they're made from like stone and clay, and they're so colorful, like they're just completely picturesque. A lot of the actual buildings themselves are white because that area is really hot, and so it's more to keep the area cool. Mm-hmm. But they really do get creative with like the colors they use to paint the area. So that was definitely the highlight of Aswan.
Well, and if you're not familiar with Nubian, so the Nubian people would be more dark-skinned. They would look closer to the people in southern Africa. And actually, I think all Egyptians are attractive. It's my personal, you know, you sometimes get that impression from different things, but much lighter skinned in the north in lower Egypt and much darker skinned in the south in the Nubian area. Mm-hmm. Yeah, wonderful, soft-spoken, beautiful people. Definitely recommend that. But I also like the day trip to Abu Simbel.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So technically, like, I guess it's like something you do in Aswan, even though it's like 4 hours away, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely something if people have the time is like not to miss it. There's two ways to get to Abu Simbel. So you can either fly, but the flights, I believe, only operate like every other day or something like that. So when I was there, that wasn't an option. So we actually woke up at like 4 a.m. and we took like a 4-hour bus to Abu Simbel. But yes, that is also obviously like one of the most impressive things to do in Upper Egypt.
And it's an odd thing because if you go to Abu Simbel, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, but this is the temple that is built into the side of the mountain, just not the original mountain, because this is a temple that was moved when the building of the Aswan Dam flooded the original. And so it was moved in part with help from Americans. So if you ever go to the Met Museum, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, you will see a small Egyptian temple that was given to America as a gift to recognize the help that was given moving the Abu Simbel, moving it out of the way of the rising levels of the floodwaters from the lake built behind the Aswan Dam.
Yeah, I remember when I learned that, and I was like mind blown that they moved an entire temple.
Well, two, because there's two temples right next to each other, and then they also moved, as I recall, the Temple of Isis or the Philae Temple, which was also saved from the floodwater. So there's at least three that I can come up with that were moved. That one I actually enjoyed because from Aswan, you take a boat, very touristy boats, but very interesting. Almost looks like doing the Jungle Cruise from Disneyland.
Yes. I can't believe I forgot to mention that one. See, I feel like now all the temples are like in my head just mixed up, but you're right. Yeah. How could I forget the Philae Temple, which is to me like the main temple that's worth seeing in Aswan, right? I mean, Abu Simbel aside, which I kind of technically Aswan, but yeah, you're right. The Philae Temple is also like a really cool experience. Even just taking the boat alone, I felt like it was like part of the fun.
I agree. I completely agree. And as a photographer, I just loved it for the photography of that experience.
Right. I mean, and even when you start at the port, there's a lot of creativity, sort of the port for Philae is what I mean. Mm-hmm. In that area, you know, you have all these like colorful boats and like really quirky and fun. They're a little bit touristy souvenirs, but even so, I think it's just like a really fun vibe. So it's like you're getting excited before you even get on the boat.
Well, and as I recall, our guide was choosing which vendor would get to sail out with us. So they were, he was just swarmed by people who were saying, you know, here's what you should, you know, here's what I'm doing, here's what I'm showing it. And then he went, okay, you're coming with us. And so there was a young boy who was selling his goods on the boat, but just the one.
So, that's so funny.
Yeah.
I love that he incorporated a local experience there.
Excellent. I think that may have been your itinerary.
Yeah, so that's pretty much it. I guess the only other thing I would add is a lot of times when people end up back in Cairo, if they have an extra day, you can take a day trip to Alexandria. Mm-hmm. I would just quickly like to say that like Alexandria is really interesting because that was an area that was once overtaken by Alexander the Great. There's no pharaonic history there.
Right.
So you're getting more of the European history, and you can see that in the historical artifacts and buildings that are there.
Excellent. If you had to add on a day to go someplace else besides Alexandria, any place else that you would add on?
Yeah, actually. So the White and Black Deserts, and they're about, I want to say like 3 hours from Cairo. So it's more of an overnight trip. You could do it in a day trip, but it would be kind of a long one. There's a bunch of limestone rock formations in the desert. that have kind of been formed over the course of time between, you know, the wind and the sand and rain and just sort of erosion into some really cool, fun shapes. And it's all this like huge collection just in the desert. One of my favorite things that I did was camp there overnight, and being able to see the sunrise over the limestone landscape was really otherworldly.
Excellent. As we go to wrap this up, you are standing in the prettiest spot in Egypt. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
At the Red Sea. It okay. doesn't matter necessarily which city I'm in. I could be in Sharm el Sheikh, I could be in Hurghada, but I am just standing at the Red Sea and just seeing the clearest, bluest water. And there's, even though I'm not far from the shoreline, there's little fish swimming around everywhere.
Well, and if you were going to take somebody diving, that is the most common dive spot, that in Alexandria, to go see the ruins of the Lighthouse of Alexandria. You can do that in Alexandria. But when you talk about diving, that's yeah. where most people go.
People, yes, they do go there. And then also Deheb is like another cool like spot that's okay. gotten really a lot more attention in
that
the last
I do not know.
Few okay. years. Yeah, so there's actually a huge sinkhole there called the Blue Hole. And so that's also like a really, I actually don't dive myself, but I've seen enough photos for, it makes me really want to learn.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, that's another place that I think if you're into diving, going to the Blue Hole in Deheb is a must.
Excellent. And that is, again, on the Red Sea.
That is Sinai. Yeah.
Yep. Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Egypt.
Oh, man. Being in a car on the streets of Cairo and just randomly seeing somebody riding a donkey mm-hmm. with like a cart attached that's selling oh, yeah. like fruit or pita bread or something, just like randomly next to all the cars. Very Egyptian.
The traffic, once you throw in the donkey carts and the crazy driving and the pedestrians jumping out in the middle of things, is interesting.
Yes, it's definitely shocking. I think one of the first things I noticed when I got there was like, how does this chaotic ecosystem of traffic work? Like, mm-hmm. it was mind-boggling.
Well, and I think of, actually, question for you, one warning you would give. One thing you should know before you go.
This is a hard one because I feel like it's almost like a little bit of a negative, right? I like hate to speak negatively, but I think one thing is also just because of just like how Egypt has been politically over the last decade or so, it's mm-hmm. economically has suffered a lot. And because of that, people see tourists as sort of, unfortunately, as like dollar sure. signs, right?
Well, that's not just Egypt, but yes.
Yeah. And so I just think it's like, be wary of somebody who's, you know, people are trying to, are overly friendly and trying to help you, or just generally, I think there's just a lot of, more often than not, is that overly helpfulness, or in general, there's a lot of scams that happen in terms of scamming tourists. And so I think it's also just being a little bit cautious and cognizant of that is something that I would warn people about.
And you say cautious, and I have to laugh because my wife still laughs at me. We arrived at Cairo at 1 a.m. was when our flight got in, you know, which is always a great place to go to a foreign country. And we were by ourselves. We didn't have somebody waiting with a sign for us or something like that. So we get out of the airport. You know, first we had to figure out the whole visa system, which was a little bit complicated in the airport. And then we got out and someone, of course, was there speaking English saying, "Can I get you a cab?" And in general, I'd say that a lot of travel advice is you don't do that. You go to a cab stand or things like that. And I said, sure.
Oh, no.
And so the guy took our bags and walked into the night. And we're running to catch up with him. And by the time we get to the cab, he's throwing things in the trunk. We think we didn't actually see our stuff go in the trunk. And my wife is saying, are you sure this is a good idea? And I'm thinking, I think so. We got to our hotel fine. You know, sometimes you just have to read the situation and you get lucky. But I did not have a level of caution that she was comfortable with.
Yeah. And here's the thing is, like, obviously there are always, like in any country, it's like there's people that are good and there to help the tourists and yep. they're not going to try to scam you. But I think on the flip side, it's always good to be a little bit more cautious. And so I think there's certain things. And I think having a guide, honestly, is like helps you avoid a lot of these scams.
Sure.
And also just makes it a more enjoyable experience, right? Mm-hmm. You're just less likely to get harassed as a tourist when you're at these different sites or when you're shopping or doing any of that stuff, because you have a guide who can kind of help you navigate and mm-hmm. sort of, for lack of a better word, protect you. And it's more just so that you can enjoy the experience without feeling like you're constantly having to worry about someone trying to scam you or fighting them off because you don't want to buy their scarf or whatever. I think that's one thing in Egypt that I think people feel like, oh, I don't need a guide. Like, I'm an experienced traveler. But I'm like, honestly, a guide is going to enhance your experience more likely than not. So that's one thing that I probably don't recommend in every country that you visit. But I think mm-hmm. in Egypt, just having, even if you just hire, like, it's you and a couple other people or whatever, but you just hire one guide for your group, it makes a difference, I would say.
I think in ancient Egypt, especially as you're going through things, somebody who can read the hieroglyphics and tell you what the story is that's on the wall makes it different than just, it's just another temple. Now, I can tell you what the story is. The story is, here's the god, and here's Pharaoh, and here's the god saying that I like Pharaoh. But it's still useful.
Yeah. And after a while, you're like, did everyone just write the same story on these walls? But
Pretty much. But
you're right. It really just enhances the experience. And in a lot of countries, you can totally get away with not having a guide, and you're still going to have a great time and learn a lot.
Absolutely.
And I think Egypt, though, having a guide is more an enhancement than a hindrance.
Well, and it's not easy to become a guide in Egypt. They're very qualified, and I have a great deal of respect for them. Excellent. Sally Elisser has been our guest from PassportAndPlates.com. Sally, first of all, if you wanted to summarize Egypt in just three words, what three words would you use?
All right. If I was going to summarize Egypt in three words, I would say energetic.
Okay.
Historical filled, using a hyphen, so that counts as one word, right?
Okay. We'll give you that.
And fun. It's Excellent. A good time. Like, no matter what you do, no matter where you go and what your itinerary looks like, you're guaranteed to come back with some great stories about not just the places that you saw, but the people that you met, the experiences, just being in traffic, just traveling by train, whatever you do, like, you're guaranteed to have a good time, to learn some history, and just to feel like exhilarated by the place.
Excellent. And if we're going to send people to your best post on Egypt at passportandplates.com, where are we going to send them?
You're going to send them to the 30 best things to do in Cairo. Because
Excellent.
I think Cairo is really an underrated city and that people should see more than just the top few sites there.
Well, and we always talk about a one-week itinerary. You have my permission to not just go for 1 week in Egypt. It's just 1 week is what fits into an hour-long format, too. Right. Sally, thank you so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Egypt.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Thanks again to the patrons who support the show. I'm looking forward to seeing you, or at least those of you who could make it next week at our monthly patron Zoom. To support the show, you can go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. In news of the community, I heard from Savio Wong, former guest on the show way back in an episode on Botswana, who said, I'm going to give you some feedback on two recent episodes. As usual, enjoy your show and keep up the good work. Episode 727, Kanchanaburi. Just finished listening to the Kanchanaburi episode. I spent half a day there in January 2019. I wish I had more time due to a number of constraints. I had to join a guided day tour from Bangkok, and that made a stop at Dam Noen floating market en route. My interest is in World War II history, and glad I made the trip. By the way, January is a great time to be in Thailand because its winter is dry, warm, and comfortable. I did visit the Kanchanaburi War Cemetery that your guest Michael mentioned. Similar to the other cemeteries maintained by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, a cross of sacrifice is surrounded by rows and rows of tombs. I went to the Jeeth, Japan, England, Australia, America, Thailand, Holland Museum, the one that Michael didn't recommend. He is correct that the museum is not well organized or curated. However, if you're interested in that part of history, there were plenty of artifacts to be discovered. For example, there was a room filled with stacks and stacks of Japanese war currency and also lots of newspaper clippings from that period. Walking across the bridge over the River Kwai, Kwai was surreal. In fact, that was my second visit to the River Kwai. The first time was almost 30 years ago, and I recalled having to step aside to a small platform in the middle of the bridge so that a train could pass. Episode 726, Wales. I got a few ideas for my next visit to Wales. Your guest didn't mention two destinations in Wales that I think should be on the list for any bibliophiles: Hay-on-Wye and Gladstone Library. First, Hay-on-Wye. This small town is known for its bookstores. Since the advent of online booksellers, the number of bookstores has gone down to only 20+. The main one is housed in an old castle. Every June, Hay-on-Wye hosts a book festival. The town is a popular spot for day trippers. To experience the tranquil morning before the arrival of day trippers is worth staying overnight. Second is the Gladstone's Library. Gladstone's Library is located in Hawarden in North Wales. I took a train from London to the town of Chester and hopped on a local bus to get there. As a former librarian, it was a dream come true to be able to spend a couple of nights in a library. One of the privileges of staying in Gladstone's is visiting the reading room in the evening. Gladstone's also has a lovely gourmet restaurant, and there is a local pub just down the road. Cheers, Savio. And Savio added some pictures, which I put in this episode. Thanks so much. It's always good to get feedback and also some additional suggestions. I've been giving you some suggestions from our affiliates, amateurtraveler.com/affiliates, for purchasing travel. I know that a lot of you really aren't purchasing travel right now, but here's a great place to go for just dreaming about where you'll go when we can travel again, and that's airtreks.com, airtreks.com, and that's a place that helps you plan a round the world ticket. Can you just imagine that when you can finally travel again, finally doing that round the world trip you've been dreaming of? airtreks.com, amateurtraveler.com/affiliates. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.